Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, March 1st. I'm Ray Graff. So there's this antenna. It's a little bigger than a refrigerator, and they put it out in the desert out in Australia. And with this relatively modest-sized $5 million antenna, scientists think they may have glimpsed the dawn of the universe and maybe detected dark matter as well. To sort all this out today is our resident astronomer, Bob Berman. He is back to answer your questions about all things astronomical. 800-348-2551 is the number. 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is here. The moon, the sky, the sun. It's all coming up on Vox Pop after the news. Well, good afternoon. The time is now 10 minutes after 2 o'clock. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Renowned astronomer Bob Berman has touched down in Studio A to field all of your astronomy-related questions today. He is the author of many books, the most recent of which is Zapped. And he is, well, you can find him all over the place, Discover Magazine, Astronomy Magazine. He's the astronomy editor of the Old Farmer's Almanac. Always great to have Bob Berman on this program. Our number is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. You can also email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, our number, jot it down on your wall, 800-348-2551. Bob Berman, welcome back.
Thanks, Ray. Good to be back.
How are book sales for Zapped?
I have no idea.
You haven't got any cha-ching yet?
No. They send these reports twice a year, and it hasn't. Zapped came out too recently. I haven't seen anything.
Enough with the reports. You want checks or cash.
Right.
the news that is, I guess, as big as you can get in astronomy, and space.com is tweeting it out, and this is from the Associated Press. After the Big Bang, it was cold and black, and then there was light. Now, for the first time, astronomers have glimpsed that dawn of the universe 13.6 billion years ago when the earliest stars were turning on the light in the cosmic darkness. And if that's not enough, they may have detected mysterious dark matter at work, too. All of this from a very faint radio signal from deep space.
It's desperation.
Desperation?
Yeah, because dark matter seems to be there ever since 1933 when Fritz Zwicky noticed that all the galaxies in our local group are flying around so fast, there shouldn't be a local group. They should have all gone their separate ways and overcome the collective gravity, the Borg identity, the Borg collective thing. But they don't. So there's something there that's making gravity other than things that we know make gravity, like stars and planets and stuff. And so since then, that's going back three quarters of a century now, we've assumed that there's something called dark matter. Dark because doesn't give off any light, doesn't reflect light, but it has gravity. So what is it? And there's all sorts of ideas and nothing has ever been proven. And some physicists think it doesn't exists, and it's gravity alone that acts strangely at low levels to explain this. So this is an important discovery because this suggests that there is dark matter, and it was around early on. We're talking about just a matter of 180 million years after the Big Bang.
Some scientists are very excited about this. Harvard astronomer Avi Loeb says, if confirmed, this discovery deserves two Nobel Prizes for both capturing the signal of the first stars and potential dark matter confirmation.
Well, the idea is that the first stars were probably massive. They give out a lot of UV radiation, and then they would have affected the way the hydrogen gas, which was what was prevalent then and still is, would have behaved. And the signal from the hydrogen shows that it's moving more slowly. Motion is temperature. So it's moving more slowly, meaning it's not as cold as we thought. So what would be slowing down all of that early hydrogen? It could have been this dark matter. And so that's the first evidence other than the motion of objects in our current universe that suggests that dark matter is real.
The interesting thing from a radio standpoint is there's so much signal. There's the microwave background radiation from the Big Bang. All the stars and galaxies put out so much RF that to pick up this tiny, faint signal, they had to go to the middle of Australia where there is nothing.
No especially FM. FM would interfere with it.
Right.
Yeah, you radio guys, you love the radio business.
Very exciting, isn't it?
It's true. That's true.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest, and let's go over to Zach in Amherst. Zach, you're first.
Hi, Bob. Hey, Ray.
Hi.
Bob, you made a mention of the sort of limbo we might experience a couple of months back. We might be able to see the signature of free oxygen in an extrasolar planet, but we might never be able to see it because our telescopes are simply not too powerful enough. And my question to you is, would there be a theoretical future telescope that might be powerful enough to see surface features, atmosphere, or something that would give us a little more of an insight as to whether there is at least vegetation on an extrasolar planet?
Well, wow, you can never say never, but when you're talking about an extrasolar planet, you're talking about, remember, stars are dots, right? You know that. Through the biggest telescope, a star is a single pixel. So a planet going around that star is a sub-pixel, but you can't get smaller than a pixel and still have any detection. So it's still one pixel. And when you have one pixel, you have no information. By definition, there's no detail within a pixel. And so even the largest planet, let's say Jupiter, if a Jupiter existed around the nearest star, Proxima Centauri, in the Alpha Centauri system, what would Jupiter show through our largest telescopes? One pixel. So if you're asking for details, which is what you're saying, vegetation or something else, no. But here's what you could hope, that spectroscopically you would detect, you said it correctly a moment ago, oxygen, for example, at various wavelengths, 5577 angstroms and others, 5009 angstroms. There are signatures of oxygen and free oxygen. Whoa, that is something. Earth did not have free oxygen at the beginning. And when you get the cyanobacteria and others that created free oxygen from the carbon dioxide, in other words, it loosened the grip of the oxygen, then there was free oxygen. It doesn't last because then that oxygen is sucked up by the iron on Earth to make iron oxide. It's sucked up by the silicon to make sand and quartz. It's sucked up by hydrogen to make H2O, water. And everything loves oxygen. So you end up with no free oxygen in the atmosphere. You need so much oxygen by some process in order for there to be left over from what all the elements don't grab so that there's free oxygen, that we really believe that we've got this 21% oxygen atmosphere only because we've got plants on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And if this applies elsewhere, which we think it must, then only a plant system, biology, life, could produce free oxygen. And therefore, that's what we want to see. We want to detect oxygen on an exoplanet. And then we don't even need the details of plants. We know that's where we want to go.
All right, Zach, thank you for the call. Bob Berman is our guest today. Our number is 800-348-2551. Joel in Blooming Grove. Joel, you're on.
Yes, good afternoon, and thank you for taking this call. My question is, what is the temperature of light? And I'm going to hang up my phone and listen on the radio now. Thank you.
Thank you, Joel.
Well, thanks for that. Temperature really means motion of objects, particularly atoms and molecules. Our word for the motion, the jiggling of atoms or molecules, the word is heat or temperature. So when you feel sick, and let's say you have a fever and your body is 3 degrees warmer, what's really happening is your atoms are jiggling about 4 miles per second faster than normal.
Really?
Yeah. And so that's what we call temperature. But you have to have those atoms moving, otherwise temperature doesn't mean anything. Now, light isn't an atom, and so you have energy in electromagnetic radiation, and the shorter each wave is, the more of them pass a given point per second, and so there's more energy in shorter wavelengths of light, but that's not the same thing as temperature. It's just energy. So temperature, you can't say what temperature is light because light can't have temperature.
But it has photons.
Well, a photon is a bit of light, and it has energy. You can express the energy
There's no mass.
Of light, but no mass.
Okay.
Remember the Roberto Durant.
No mass, right.
Yeah.
Bob Berman is our guest. Our number is 800-348-2551. We'll take our first break here and get back to the phones. Bob Berman and you coming up.
Support for WAMC comes from the Department of Theater Arts, SUNY New Paltz, presenting Water by the Spoonful, a returning Iraq soldier struggles with civilian life. Through March 11th, newpaltz.edu/theater. The Hyde Collection in Glens Falls this winter features an exhibition of The Art of Alphonse Mucha, 75 works highlighting the sinuous lines and whiplash curves that came to define Art Nouveau. HydeCollection.org. George Heigl Antiques, Ballston Spa, New York, specializing in buying and selling antique collections for individuals, families, and businesses. 518-396-7974. And from Interim Healthcare for 47 years, helping families keep loved ones at home, providing companions, aides, and nurses in the Greater Capital Region, Columbia and Saratoga Counties, and Glens Falls. InterimHealthcare.com.
Frank Zappa, the Grand Wazoo, here on Vox Pop, 2:20 on a Thursday afternoon. Ray Graff here with Bob Berman, and your questions about astronomy at 800-348-2551. Bob, you're heading to Alaska.
I am, next week.
That's exciting. This is the Northern Lights trip.
Yep, been doing it every year for decades now. Who goes to Alaska in March, right? But
Bob Berman does.
That's right.
I hope you have success.
I hope so too. I've been hearing you're not a member of the tour, so
no,
it won't. It won't give you great sorrow to hear this, but right now the sun is pretty quiet.
Oh yeah.
And I hope for the first time in 20 years we don't get a bust. We've always seen auroras, and I just keep my fingers crossed for these people.
Well, even when the sun is very quiet, usually you get a little.
Usually
action.
We get them there. Yeah. Yeah. So.
Well, our number here is 800-348-2551 if you have a question for Bob. And let's go over to Jim in North Pownell, Vermont. Jim, you're on.
Hi, Ray. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
Bob, I love listening to you explain things on the radio, and I love reading your articles in the Almanac. But I have a rather personal question for you.
Oh, boy.
When I was studying earth science back in the 70s, I took several astronomy courses with a guy named Philip Liu, and he used to go down to Peru every summer and go to some observatory there. And I was just wondering if you knew him or knew of him.
No, neither of them. And although I've been to Peru, our yearly trips are always to Chile in there. So I don't know much about observatories in Peru, even though it's a great country.
Okay, I was just curious.
Right, but thank
thanks,
you.
But I really enjoy your shows.
Oh,
I really
you.
Do.
Thank you.
I
appreciate that. Thank
okay.
you.
Have a good one. Thanks for the call. Our number is 800-348-2551. Bob Berman, the guest, and Pete in Great Barrington. Pete.
Hello, gentlemen.
Hi.
I will reiterate what the last guy said. I love when you two guys are on the radio.
That's
first,
nice.
Bob, I wanted to thank you for inspiring me. Your waxing poetic about seeing a total eclipse inspired me to drive to Greensboro, South Carolina, August 21st, which was my birthday, and experiencing the totality.
Oh, great.
And it was really, really a remarkable experience.
Oh, I'm so glad you did that. I'm so glad you did that. So you had good weather then.
It was perfect. I was in a great location on a little lake with a sandbar that went out into the lake, so there was no trees. It was absolutely spectacular. Anyway, I have a question about the I saw a model of the sun and the planets rotating around it, and then the whole mess was sort of transiting through space. And I wondered if I imagine that must be accurate. I'd always thought of it in sort of like this static model of, you know, a dot with planets running around it. And I said, well, of course the sun must be moving I mean, it's not standing still, correct?
Correct, correct. Absolutely
right. Transiting from one place in the universe to another?
Yeah, the major motion that the sun takes, taking us with it, is at 144 miles per second.
That's fast.
A lot faster than the mere 18 and a half miles per second that Earth goes around the sun. So this is a whole different level of speed around the center of our galaxy. So we could think of our galaxy as a disk that's rotating, or you could think of every little of the hundreds of billions of stars in the galaxy having their own orbits around the center, our sun being one of them, taking Earth and the other planets along for the ride. But yes,
our sun is essentially traveling around. When you look at, when you envision the galaxy as a flat disk, we are in that flat disk going around that, the center of, okay, makes sense. Great. Thank you very much. That
sure thing.
Cleared up a lot for me.
And by the way, one could even see the motion in the summer, let's say on August nights, if you face the east. Raise your right hand and you're pointing towards Sagittarius, the center of the galaxy. That's the place we're going around. And the direction is straight ahead. It's in the east, low in the east, on summer nights. So we're heading that way toward the east, going around that place to the south. And so you can even get a feel of our galactic rotation and the direction the sun is taking us.
And how long would it take the solar system to make one galactic year?
Yes, one galactic year. Some source books say 225 million years. Some say 240 million years.
It's not that long. And the center of the galaxy is a black hole?
It is, yes. Yeah, Sagittarius A star. Not a pretty wimpy black hole as those things go. Only weighs about as much as 4 million suns, which is a lot less than the 9 billion suns in the galaxy M87. But still, yes, you're right. Black hole in the middle.
And the solar systems, now, I know in our solar system, all the planets but one are on a plane, right?
Yeah, they're all inclined to a certain degree. And
what about solar systems in the galaxy?
No, they're random. They're
really?
All inclined in random directions. And that flat plane, it deviates. Mercury is just 7 degrees from the flat plane, which isn't much. Venus is 3.4 degrees. The planet most perfectly aligned with the same plane as ours is Uranus at 0.7 degrees. Pluto, when it was a planet, is 17 degrees. That was the most inclined. But considering that you could have an inclination of up to 90, even Pluto's 17 wasn't much. So, yeah, all pretty much the same flat plane.
And if solar systems are more or less randomly spread throughout the galaxy, and they're all orbiting, why haven't there been more collisions between solar systems?
Because the main thing in every solar system is the star that has 99% of the mass.
Right.
And stars are separated. You'll like this. Stars are separated on average by 1 million star diameters. So if you picture a speck, a bullet, separated from another bullet by 1 million bullet lengths, and then fire them randomly, you know, what are the chances that they're going to hit?
Well, over billions of years. And how many solar systems are there in the galaxy?
Or
stars, anyway.
400 billion, at least.
I would think the odds of a collision would over a billion years would be decent.
And yet we've never seen one. But galaxies are only separated from each other, on average, by 20 galaxy widths.
And they will collide. In fact,
so
we're subsuming another one, are we not?
Andromeda, in just a few billion years, yes.
That'll be exciting.
Yeah, we're looking forward to it.
You'll have to do one of your field trips for that one. Bob Berman is our guest. Let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551. Jay in Albany. Jay.
Hi, how are you today, Bob? Thanks for the vine, as
good, thank you.
Romy would say.
All right.
Yes. I have a couple questions. The first one is, what is the difference between astronomy and astrophysics?
They're pretty much two terms that are interchangeable. Astrophysics is sort of the more hoity-toity way of saying it. It is more physics and math-oriented. Astronomy could be the same as astrophysics. Some would use it. For example, the courses that I used to teach at college were sometimes called astronomy and sometimes called astrophysics. But astronomy also lets you say that you're an amateur astronomer. You've learned the stars and constellations. You have a telescope. And you wouldn't be an astrophysicist because you're not interested in math. You're not interested in research. And so a little bit of a diversion there, but basically the same.
Chemical makeup of stars, and et cetera. And yeah. The chemistry and physics of it all.
Right.
So, and my other question is, according from the results of the Kepler mission, Ray was talking about the prevalence of planetary systems, and I'd say that planetary systems are about as rare as dirt.
You're right, and the smart money is on every star having a planetary system. And if there's 400, the usual figure that you'll see is 400 billion stars in our Milky Way galaxy. Sometimes you'll see more, sometimes you'll see less. And so if everyone has at least a few planets, you know, you do the math, it's probably a trillion planets in our own galaxy.
Anything as massive as a star is going to have things orbiting around it. It just stands to reason if, you know, a small planetoid can have, like Pluto can have Charon.
Right. Well, I mean, there's always an exception to a rule when there are that many stars, so we can't say every star has planets.
Right. And now, this might be obnoxious of me because you said Charon, and I love the fact that you actually know the name of Pluto's biggest moon, and it's spelled Charon, but it's pronounced Karen, like the girl's name Karen.
Karen. Okay.
Uh-huh. I'm just reading an old Discover from November 04, and David Brown of Caltech, his first mention, cites that Pluto, I think it in terms, Pluto is not a planet.
Okay.
Yep, well, that's where...
He's the guy. Well, Jay, thanks a lot for the call. We got to move it on here, but thank you very much. 800-348-2551 is our number. Bob Berman is our guest. Maria in Fonda. Maria, you're on.
Hello. Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a couple of questions for Mr. Berman. I'm wondering if he's familiar with the author Greg Braden and his book Fractal Time, and would he recommend reading that book?
Fractal Time.
Never heard of it. I never heard of the guy or the book.
Can you give us a quick description, Maria?
Yes. Mr. Braden says that time operates in cycles, or ages, and each age is about 5,100 years per age, and that this current age ended on in 2012, and that there are certain signs.
Isn't that the Mayan calendar?
The ending of the time.
Didn't the Mayans have a 5,000 year? Yeah, okay. Well,
yes.
I guess Bob hasn't read that one. Do you have another question?
Yes. Mr. Braden says right now that we're at the, he says the path of the our solar system around the center of the galaxy is an ellipsis.
An ellipse, yes, it is.
And I'm just wondering, which I think that is true. But I just wondered of what part of the ellipsis we're on.
Well, it's called, it's
Mr.
not.
Braden,
you're right. It's an ellipse.
The farthest distance from the center of the galaxy.
Okay.
Yeah, we're neither at the closest or the farthest, and our orbit's not a particularly eccentric one. So it's more round than highly eccentric, and everything in the universe. Goes around whatever it's going around in ellipses. The roundest orbits are actually the three of the moons of Jupiter. They're about as circular as you can get. Of the planetary orbits, the roundest is Venus. And we express the roundness or eccentricity of an orbit by dividing its foci, the focuses of an ellipse, by the length of the major axis, and you get a number. Zero is a perfectly round object. One would be a theoretical, so stretched out ellipse that it would look like a straight line. So Venus is 0.007, very, very round.
Okay.
Pluto was the worst at 0.25. That's how the ellipses vary here in our own solar system. So everything is ellipses, yes.
Well, thank you, Maria, for the call. And there is no chance of a 0-0?
Yeah, because the slightest encounter with something else gravitationally or an impact is going to knock that off from perfect 0-0. But the Io Europa and Ganymede have orbits that are 0.0000 something, so they're very close to
zero. Do we know why?
To perfect zero. Obviously, they were formed as Jupiter was formed, so it was a spinning proto. Plasmic object, a single object that condensed into the separate planets, but because they were there from the get-go, they have round.
Interesting.
Orbits.
So you're saying that the moons of, or those three moons of Jupiter, yeah, were formed of the same stuff Jupiter was formed of.
Yes, yes, yes. And one more moon outward from them, Callisto, although its orbit is still quite circular, but not as circular as the others. Yes.
So what does that tell us about Jupiter? I thought there was some question about whether it had a solid core at all.
It does, but we're not talking about the core. We're just talking about the whole body of the mass. And
right.
Those planets were once part of the outer parts of
that. But those moons are solid, presumably.
They're liquidy. Actually, they're watery. Watery.
Really?
Yeah.
All
yeah.
of them?
Yeah. Well, in the center, yeah.
All right, let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551. Bob Berman, the guest, and David in Rhinebeck is next. David.
Hi, Bob. Thank you so much for all the info. I caught you. You gave a speak out here at Star Library in Rhinebeck last year, and it inspired us to go out to St. Louis to view the totality. And just wanted to thank you for that.
Good. Now I don't believe it was a total in St. Louis, so you went outside of the city, I hope.
Right? That's right. We went west, actually, to what's called Mizzou, the state, University of Missouri. Which is, I think, Columbia, and they were in the center of the swath.
Good. Did you get good weather for it?
Oh, we had fabulous weather for it and great company. Oh, shout nice. Out to Mizzou, to all the people that made us really feel at home.
Good.
It's,
good.
You know, Missouri has some troubles right now, but Mizzou is doing absolutely fine. I felt like I was home.
No, I'm so glad you went. I'm so
really,
glad
really
you went.
Great. Yeah, oh, we are too. Everybody was so jealous. You went to see it. Oh, yeah, I'm a superstar. It was great.
I have a feeling the next one in 2024, we're going to have some big crowds that time.
It'll be closer.
It'll be closer, and people are now psyched for it. And people like you who've now been to one, I'm sure you'll go to the next.
Oh, yeah, definitely. But I think I'm going to go south for the good weather.
All right.
Yes.
Do you have a question, David?
Like, we're going to be at the top of Vermont, I think.
Right.
You got a question?
But anyway, I was, you know, you're giving us the speeds of the planet and the speeds of our whole solar system. And what are you measuring it against? I mean, and then you're like, oh, there's some people say 3 billion planets and some say 20 billion. And everything's got to be an estimate. We can't really be sure.
Yeah, and very good point. There are things that we have absolutely down perfectly, and there are things that we can only estimate. For example, if you ask me how long is the Martian day, I could tell you to the second it's 24 hours, 37 minutes, and 23 seconds, because we've been observing it for centuries. We've been watching the same features go around, and that's not going to change even in a century from now. But when you say how many stars are in our galaxy, well, there are many that are too faint to be detected, and we only have to infer their existence from overall gravity fields. And so there's a little bit of wiggle room, but it's going to be roughly what we think. So you're quite right. The facts in astronomy range from quite sure to quite speculative.
Hmm.
Oh, and your other point was, what do we measure speeds? It's all relative, and you're absolutely right. We always have to say relative to something. Like when we say Earth going around the sun, well, that's easy. We can say 18 and a half miles per second because we're comparing Earth with the sun, which isn't moving. In our, at least when we're talking about the solar system, we know that it is moving. And then when we're talking about the sun's moving, we're comparing it to the rest of the galaxy. So you're right. There always has to be a comparison, which is why it's tricky when we talk about the Milky Way and Andromeda. We're going to collide in a few billion years, but who's moving towards who? We know that the distance is closing by 70 miles a second. Every second, we're 70 miles closer to Andromeda. But is it they who are coming toward us or we that's going toward them. There's no graph paper out there. There's no way to know absolute motion, which is what your point is, and it's an excellent point.
Yeah.
So we cannot say who is moving toward who. So instead we just say the distance between us shrinks by 70 miles per second, and we leave it at that.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. But and yet you say all the galaxies are racing apart faster and faster. I'm having trouble wrapping those two concepts together.
Well, that we've known since 1929, because whenever we measure the Doppler shift, the way light changes because of the speed of motion, we see that for every million light years of distance, galaxies are reliably moving 14 miles per second faster in a direction directly away from us. So we call that the Hubble
but
flow.
How can we collide with Andromeda?
Because all those galaxies that are moving apart, what I should have said is that galaxy clusters are moving apart from other galaxy clusters. Within any galaxy cluster, there's no expansion. And Andromeda is in our own galaxy cluster. So there's a whole beehive-like gravity.
So we're like billiard balls on a table.
Yeah, we're gravitationally bound. Our cluster of about 30 galaxies, and Andromeda is one of them. So we're not expanding. We're not taking part of the Hubble expansion.
Bob Berman is our guest. Our number is 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. Yeah, all right, a little more Zappa.
Support for WAMC comes from the Daily Hampshire Gazette, providing news and information for Hampshire County in print and online. GazetteNet.com. Identity Eyewear, Albany, New York, specializing in distinctive eyewear, featuring new styles for 2018. Eye exams by appointment, 518-459-2638. Hadley Garden Center, Hadley, Massachusetts. Locally owned and operated for over 50 years. Offering indoor and outdoor plants, gardening supplies, organic fertilizer, and advice. HadleyGardenCenter.com. And from Saratoga Jewish Community Arts, presenting the film The Ritchie Boys, Sunday, March 25th, 7 p.m. at Temple Sinai, Saratoga Springs. 518-584-8730. Option number 2 for reservations.
Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here, 800-348-2551, the telephone number. Astronomer Bob Berman is our guest, and you're heading to Alaska next week. How do people find out more about your tours?
Specialinteresttours.com.
Okay, and you have things. You're going to be going to Chile again in the summer?
Not this year. Our next Chile trip is for the total eclipse that's there next year.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. Well, Bob Berman is our guest, and back to the phones we go. We go over to Paul and Troy. Paul, you're on.
Hi, guys. How you doing?
Good.
Simple question, and it's relevant to the upcoming Alaska trip. As you said, Bob, this is a quiet year for solar activity. On the cycle, when do you see the next major, really active year coming up?
Well, okay. It's roughly an 11-year cycle. The maximum was what now, 4 years ago, 5 years ago? I'm losing track of time. I'm always told, no, we didn't do that last year. We did that 12 years ago. So you're almost asking the wrong person. But if I remember right, the last sunspot maximum was about 4 or 5 years ago.
It was
ago.
So underwhelming. I can't remember when the peak was.
And we've got another 5, 6, 7 years to go before the next maximum.
So it would be roughly at the midpoint of the cycle.
Yeah, we're heading towards the minimum point of the cycle.
Right. So 5, 6 years down the pike.
Yeah.
Okay. That's it for me. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot. And, of course, it seems like the last solar cycle was very low. The peak was very unexciting.
You're right.
And can we infer that there is a major, a larger cycle at work here?
Many are worried. Solar experts are wondering about the Maunder minimum.
Right.
That was that period from 1645 to 1715, 70-year period when the solar cycle just stopped. The heartbeat of the sun stopped, and we had almost no sunspot. No sunspots were seen for 5 straight years, not one on the sun, until where astronomers thought that the early observers like Galileo, who'd reported them, they must have been dreaming or crazy or something. And so some are wondering whether we may be on the verge of another, maybe a more minor Maunder minimum.
Because why would it be more minor, and how would they make that prediction?
We can't make that prediction because we still don't even know what quite causes it. But these, you said it, that last cycle, not only it wasn't 11 years long, it was more like 14. The low point was deep. We went months without sunspots. And then when it finally came back, it was only about two-thirds the normal strength of a solar maximum. So the sun is acting strangely. This is actually good for us because low solar activity connects with cooler temperatures on Earth just at the time when climate change or global warming, when we could use a break in terms of warming effects, the sun is coming to our rescue, really, and providing a cooling effect that's partially counterbalancing climate change. And so this is not necessarily a bad thing that this is happening.
In your book, The Sun's Heartbeat, I believe you mentioned, or maybe we talked about it on the air here, or maybe both, a reversal of polarity on the sun.
That's right, because even though people commonly say the sunspot cycle is 11 years, it's really 22 years if you account for the change in the magnetic polarity of the sunspots. In other words, south of the equator, as the sun rotates, sunspots almost always come in pairs or groups. The leading spot is positive magnetically, has a positive charge. The trailing spot is negative. In the north of the sun's equator, it's reversed. The leading spot is negative and the trailing one is positive. Well, after 11 years, the cycle dies out, spots come back, but now the polarity is reversed.
Interesting.
Now south of the sun's equator, the leading spot is negative instead of positive. So if you figure in the magnetic cycle with it, it's really a 22-year cycle.
Bob Berman, our guest today, and back to the phones we go. We go over to Tim in Oneonta. Tim, you're on.
Hi. I've been trying, I'm not a scientist, but I've been trying to understand more as much as I can about the universe and the beginning. Now, I'm reading Tyson's latest book, Astrophysics for People in a Hurry, and I believe in that. Somewhere in that book, I read that he claims that the beginning of the very big, the moment of the Big Bang consisted of only a tiny, minuscule dot of whatever, matter, energy. I find it totally inconceivable. I can't wrap my little brain around it. And I'd like to know, one, is this totally accepted and a given among cosmologists, or can it even be explained in layman's terms?
Okay, Tim. And while Bob is answering, could you turn your radio down? We're hearing a bit of a delay there.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead, Bob.
Sure.
Yeah, the Big Bang is when you say it's inconceivable to you, you're not alone, Tim, because it's inconceivable to everybody. We have an event that must have happened, because we can extrapolate reverse to the expansion of the universe and see that everything was in one place at one moment, 13.8 billion years ago. We see a ratio of hydrogen and helium and lithium that would have happened if the Big Bang happened. We see the cosmic microwave background, the 2.73-degree glow, even glow around the sky, even to one part in 80,000. Which is exactly what we would expect if there was a Big Bang. So we have all this very, very solid evidence for a Big Bang. But then we're left with, what are you left with? You're left with the universe popping out of nothingness. And yes, you're right. It would have been smaller than a marble. And we're talking about everything in the universe, every planet, every galaxy, every black hole, everything would have been in that one marble, smaller than a marble, arising out of nothingness. Now, how can you get something from nothings? But here was a whole universe. So the usual double talk answer in physics is that it was a quantum mechanical fluctuation akin to the kind that we see emerging out of nothingness on a smaller level. Like there's like snap, crackle, and popping out of empty space. There are particle pairs. And when they happen, they can even persist if there's an energy field nearby. So assumedly, given enough time, you'd get a quantum mechanical fluctuation that was the entire universe, boom, popping out of nothingness. Now, is this description a real, does this clarify anything? I don't think it really does, but because you're still left with a whole universe.
That?
Yes, and the antecedent conditions, as Ray is just bringing up, are impossible to know. And, you even back in 1929, when Hubble and his friends realized that this was the case, we knew that we were on a hamster wheel to nowhere, because anytime you try to think, well, what came before that, what caused that, you're on a series of antecedent conditions that really provides no answer. So you have this huge mystery, the whole universe popping one Saturday morning out of absolute nothingness. You can't have that, and yet all the evidence points to exactly that did happen. So that's the state of affairs.
Tim, thank you for the call. Bob Berman is our guest. 800-348-2551, the number. Craig in Brant Lake. Craig, you're on.
Yeah, how you doing? I got a quick question for you.
Sure.
Assuming that you're looking into the center of the galaxy, and there's a cluster of stars there. It seems to be a huge ball of white from our perspective. Let's say the planet Earth, or a similar Earth in the Goldilocks zone, had inhabitants inside that cluster of stars. Would there be, in fact, a nighttime for those people there? Or is it just an optical illusion that it looks like those stars are so close together, there's a super bright sky? You know what I'm saying? Would they have a night like we have nighttime?
No, I got your question. It's clear to me what you're saying. Even in the most dense type of star cluster, which are called globular star clusters, and there is one in that direction called Omega Centauri, where you have over a million suns packed into a ball only about 200 light years across. So you do get those. And when we look at them through telescopes, you're absolutely correct. It seems like one undifferentiated ball of suns. So you imagine any planet there would be bathed equally from all directions, and there'd be no night.
Yeah.
But that's not the case.
That's what it appeared to be,
That's the way, in truth, even in those globular clusters, there's about a quarter of a light year space between stars. And any planets would be orbiting one star, not more than one. So the planet would be so close to one of those stars that one would be supplying sunlight, and the others would be, they'd be brighter than the stars in our sky. They'd be all as bright as Venus or brighter. They'd be all capable of casting shadows. There would be so many bright stars that the sky probably would not be black at night. It would be blue.
Well, interesting.
But nonetheless, there'd only be one source of what we would call sunlight that's really nourishing and bathing the star, and that would be that planet's sun that it's going around.
Very interesting. Craig,
so
great question.
So astronomers with their telescopes would not have a good, easier time as we are in order to see other stars because of the light pollution they would experience.
Exactly right. We can be glad that we're not there, because to them that would be, the whole universe would be there. They couldn't see anything.
One quarter light year apart? That's close.
Yeah, that's close.
So if there were living entities, it would not be that difficult to at least communicate.
Well, a quarter light year still. You know how far we are from Pluto? One Sun-Earth distance is 164,000th of a light year.
What I'm saying is, if it's a quarter light year, do not radio waves travel at the speed of light?
Yes. So
theoretically, you could, in a half a year, say hello, hello.
Right, that
ain't bad.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, let's go to Ardeen in Duanesburg. Ardeen, you're on.
Hi.
Hi.
Here's my problem. I moved to Duanesburg 20 years ago.
Oh, that is a problem.
And enjoyed the night sky. Now, neighbors are moving in with lights that are on all night. The stars have left the sky.
Yeah, that's a common problem in this day and age.
Now, here's what you need to do. Contact the International Dark Sky organization because they'll have suggestions for you. They have a website, International Dark Sky. Yes, you're writing it down. International Dark Sky. Is it organization or association? But in any case, you'll find it.
Quick search, International Dark Sky.
And what they're going to do is suggest things like this. If you're remotely friendly with these people, go to them or write them a letter and saying that you would love to be able to do stargazing, and the solution, and it'll also save them money on electricity, is to install those automatic shutoff lights around their house. You know, the ones that are
motion sensors.
Mm-hmm. They stay on for a few minutes, then they go off. They leave the neighborhood nice and dark. And they're better at deterring crime because a potential criminal, if they see a light suddenly coming on, that's more effective than if there's just something staying on all the time.
Yeah.
And then they go on and off. And you could even, if they seem reluctant, say that you'll pay for the installation of the money because they're cheap. Pay for not the neighbors are cheap. I mean, the sensors. You know, and that's the solution. That's
so it's the International Dark Skies
Association or organization. Yes,
they will not recommend, for instance, getting a BB gun and shooting at your neighbor's.
No,
lights.
I've been tempted myself, but in where I used to live. But no. This is win-win because they'll save money on their electric bills. The sky will stay nice and dark when we live here in the country. Why not enjoy the natural beauty of the Milky Way and that kind of thing? And the deterrent to crime or when you need lights when you're stepping outside will still be there. So it's win-win all around.
All right, Bob, great solution. Let's go to Susan in Kingston. Susan, you're on.
Yes, hello there. Every time I used to bake, I used to mix up batter a lot. And when I put something in, I noticed how it goes, and I said, geez, you know, it looks like the universe. And I was thinking that somebody stirred something up that made everything look the way it does. And if you were to put stuff in the batter, let's say blueberries or nuts or whatever, and you're stirring it, you can see how it does look like the universe. I know that's odd.
That is odd. So, in other words, you had this idea when you were mixing batter that galaxies expanding outward is like mixing batter when you're putting stuff in the batter. Am I right?
Yes.
That's not a bad analogy. Not a bad analogy.
Yep. What do you think, Bob?
Try that out.
It's making me hungry.
I thought we were doing Food Friday for a minute there. You had me confused, Susan. That's cool. Well, thank you for that. We appreciate it very much. Over to Allison in Goshen, Mass. Allison, you're on.
Hi. I love your show. It's so nice to hear from both of you.
Thank you.
It's a must on my calendar.
Oh, I appreciate it.
My question, a couple of days ago when it was quite nice out, I sat outside when I could stand the temperature and watching the birds at the bird feeder, and I happened to glance at the sun, and I was surprised to see what looked like a tight little rainbow right around the sun. Now, you think of a rainbow, it's opposite the sun. This obviously wasn't that, but it was the range of colors of a rainbow, like a turtleneck right around the sun. And I kept watching it. And then a few minutes later, I glanced back. I didn't stare at it continuously. And I saw a second one that had formed around the first one, a little space in between, not quite as bright, kind of like the second rainbow. And then after a few minutes, there was the start of the formation of a third one. It was mostly just pink, and that one was irregular. And then a bit of a wind came and slowly blew the clouds away, and the whole thing ended.
Well, it's a good description. It's a good enough description that I can tell you just what you were seeing.
Oh, thank you.
White clouds in the vicinity of the sun often display a feature called cloud iridescence.
Mm-hmm.
And cloud iridescence is caused by the different sized water droplets on the edges of the clouds relative to the inside. So this will produce, and you're quite right, a rainbow has to be opposite the sun, and this is always in the vicinity of the sun. And the iridescence, here's something very beautiful about iridescence. Easier seen with sunglasses. Seen, I'd say, one out of every 3 or 4 days in the clouds immediately surrounding the sun. And here's the cool thing. They are never spectral colors. Now, spectral colors are prismatic colors. The colors of the rainbow are the familiar red, green, blue, etc. The colors that you saw, you know, you said the word pink, and you're absolutely right. Pinks, purples, browns, colors that are not spectral colors are the colors you'll see in cloud iridescence. So look for it again. It's pretty common, actually, and it's quite beautiful.
Bob Berman, thank you for being here today. We appreciate it. Support comes from Vermont Coffee Company, offering offering slow-roasted organic coffee in the brown paper bag at local grocery stores, Vermont Coffee Company, coffee roasted for friends. And Waka Waka, offering energy-efficient solar-powered flashlights and phone chargers that provide light and power to people who don't have access to electricity. No batteries or outlets needed. Share the sun, waka-waka.com. Thanks again to Bob Berman for being here. Thank you for the great questions today. Thanks to our engineer, Zach Malloy. Thanks to Deb Malik, who answered the phones. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on Food Friday, we'll be going over the basics of cooking. Well, finally, we'll be going over the basics of cooking with author Jennifer Clare. Right now, stand by for news.